Welcome to The Great Work radio program. The Great Work radio and blog are features of Jesse Waugh's website and can be accessed at jessewaugh.com. That's jessewaugh.com. We look forward to comments submitted to the blog and hope you enjoy today's program.
Hello and thank you for tuning into The Great Work. We welcome Judith Noble of the Arts University College at Bournemouth for a revealing discussion on the films of American avant-garde filmmakers Maya Deren and Kenneth Anger. I begin by asking Judith why art cinema is just now beginning to be recognized in an art historical context.
I think it's because the avant-garde film in America is mainly being studied by film theoreticians to date, and they have a very different approach from art historians. And they tend to look at the work from a very materialistic and kind of Freudian, Lacanian standpoint, and that's difficult in relation to the American avant-garde, and particularly I think in relation to Anger and to Deren, because there's so much more going on. Whereas art history looks in a more rounded way at the work and the intentions of the people who made it, their lives, their politics, how those fed the work. So it's for me, it's a much better way, I think, of looking at the work.
Do you think that that's because the work is primarily magical and therefore irrational?
I think that's got a lot to do with it. I think that film studies has found it very hard to deal with the irrational and the magical. Whereas art history at the moment is looking in quite a lot of detail at that, so that's helpful. But I think it's also just to do with this work has always been, or it's been influential massively on subsequent cinema. You know, if you listen to Scorsese, he will repeatedly talk about the influence of avant-garde filmmakers on him and other mainstream practitioners. But the work itself has been hard to see until the advent of DVD and the web, and therefore very marginal.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I mean, the one major problem with cinema as a whole is that it can't be hung on a wall.
No, exactly.
Know? So exactly. It's not seen as art, quote unquote. You know.
Absolutely, and it's even more simple than that in a way. When I first started becoming very interested in Deren's work in about 1979. In the UK, you could only see the work on 16mm film prints, and they were out of distribution.
Wow.
And so, you know, you could read in the wonderful work of P. Adam Sitney, who's a great critic, about her films, but you couldn't actually see them. And in 1980, and the subsequent 2 years, together with a woman called Felicity Sparrow, I kind of campaign to get her work reprinted and back into distribution in the UK. But it was still, you know, for a good 10 or so years, the way you could get to see Maya Deren was to hire a print from London Filmmakers Co-op, usually with me coming around and talking about it as well. You know, so it wasn't easy, if you're interested in that work, to actually get to see it.
Did the same go for Kenneth Anger? Because I went to film school in 94, 95 in L.A. and Hollywood, and they didn't even, in the film history class, they didn't even mention Kenneth Anger or Maya Deren once.
Which is extraordinary, really.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's the same with Anger, but also Kenneth Anger is quite rightly an absolute perfectionist and has always really carefully controlled the way his work is seen and the quality of it. So I can remember in the 1980s there were people distributing pirate VHS copies of his work, which of course didn't do it great justice. But he himself, you know, insisted that the work should be seen properly on good prints. And it wasn't until, some 7 or 8 years ago when the Getty Foundation financed the restoration of the prints of his work that it was easily available on DVD. So, yeah, you know, same thing going on, really.
In your talk, you mentioned something about artifacts overlooked. Does that have to do with what we're talking about?
It does. Yeah.
Okay.
It does. And all the stuff I've pulled together is very easily available. It's there in the information about the lives of these two filmmakers, and it's there in the work, but it's been an aspect of the work that's just very much been overlooked.
And you mentioned, let's get into Maya Deren a little bit. You mentioned
okay.
that you saw Maya Deren as a classicist, or she saw herself as one?
She began describing herself as a classicist from the end of the 1940s onwards. It was a description she liked, and she did a lot of work on, and I can see why it kind of really fits with the way that she structured her work and what she was trying to do, and her relationship to mythology, and there's a very intellectual aspect to her work, and I think that I kind of follow that description because it's her description, and it's the way she wanted to be seen. It's not the only aspect of the work, of course, but yes, that was how she described herself.
Was she referring to Greek mythology specifically, or just general mythology?
Yeah, I think Greco-Roman mythology. The last film in what might be called her trilogy of short films, Ritual in Transfigured Time, takes its inspiration from the idea of the three fates or the three graces. And not just the idea, but the way she shows the three fates in that film is extremely classical. The way that the characters move, the backgrounds they're set against, very, very much Greco-Roman, yeah.
How many films did Maya Deren complete?
Oh, complete. She made Messages of the Afternoon, yeah. Outland and Ritual in Transfigured Time, which are the trilogy. She made Meditation on Violence in 1947 and The Very Eye of Night in 1955-6. So that, and studying choreography for the camera in the 40s. So there are, yeah, six completed films. And she also left Witch's Cradle uncompleted. And there was a lot of footage of her work on voodoo in Haiti, which was unedited at the time of her death, which has been assembled since her death. So there are two substantial unfinished things as well.
And then in contrast, you categorized anger as a colorist.
I think so. I like that that description of him, because I think color is really the defining and most important of a characteristic of his work. It's what makes it so gorgeous and beautiful, but it also always has very precise symbolic and magical meanings. So for anger, I think, yeah, color is the most important characteristic. Yeah.
Did they ever meet, by the way, or no? Deren and anger?
Yes, I believe they did. There's not very much recorded about it, but I believe they did.
And
yeah.
What was Anaïs Nin, what was she known for?
Okay, she's a writer. Very much connected at the beginning of her career with surrealism, and was, I think, the lover of the novelist Henry Miller, and was in later life very much championed by feminists as a woman who, very much ahead of her time in the 1950s, wrote about quite extreme sexual liberation. And she leaves quite a large body of writing and some wonderful, wonderful diaries, which are published. She played one of the three fates in Deren's film, Ritual in Transfigured Time, and she gives a very full account of that in her diaries. And later on, she'd moved to the West Coast, and she features in a major way in Kenneth Anger's inauguration of the Pleasure Dome.
Oh, okay.
So she's visibly present in the films of both filmmakers in very, very different ways.
Okay, and then you'd also mentioned that Maya Deren was an associate or friend of Marcel Duchamp.
Yes. Yeah, the second film in the trilogy, Outland, uses a chess piece as a central metaphor, and it's a metaphor for Deren's own self. She starts at the beginning of the film, she, having emerged from the sea, as a kind of alien creature on the land, she finds herself in a room where people are playing chess, and the chess pieces move of their own volition, and she then steals a chess piece, which represents herself, and then kind of chases it through a series of different scenarios before very triumphantly running away with it into the distance between the land and the sea at the end of the film. So that film has chess there in a major way. And she played chess in the early 1940s in New York with Marcel Duchamp quite regularly, and he appears in the unfinished film, which is Cradle.
Okay, so he may have had some sort of influence on that motif or that idea.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay, and then you'd also mentioned three Kabbalistic initiations, that three of her films were sort of Kabbalistic initiations.
Yeah, I mean, that's very much my reading as an occultist of Derren's trilogy of films, Meshes of the Afternoon, At Land and Ritual in Transfigured Time. And I think that becomes, it's there implicitly in Meshes of the Afternoon. It becomes very apparent and explicit in At Land, and then it's worked on again in Ritual in Transfigured Time. So in the first film, the first initiation is really the discovery of the inner self and what that means. In the second film, At Land, what she's doing is placing that self in the world, and the initiation is about learning how to deal with the external world. And she writes very, very wonderfully about that in her notes for the film. And in the third film, Ritual in Transfigured Time, in a classic kind of magical, Kabbalistic initiation scenario, she is reenacting the sacred marriage and integrating the self with the other. So that's very much my reading of those three films, yeah.
When did you first hear about Maya Deren?
Well, I did a fine art degree from 1975 to 78, and my area of study that I gravitated to was experimental film. And at the time, I along with most other women students, I was very concerned to see work by women because there just wasn't any. You know, you just presented with an extremely male art world, and women were just absent from it. But in all the writing about avant-garde film at the beginning, there were all these references to the first American avant-garde filmmaker, Maya Deren. And I rapidly worked out that she was a woman and started learning about her. But as I said to you earlier, at the time, I couldn't get to see the films because the single copies of the prints of the films, which were held at the time in the UK by the British Film Institute, had really sort of got to the end of their useful life. And they weren't asked for very much, so they weren't making more copies. And it wasn't until 1980 that I managed to get the rather scratchy prints out of the archive, and I looked at them and I was amazed because the descriptions of Deren's work that I read were all about how she reinvented editing and made great advances in how an avant-garde film could be edited. And I was just absolutely shocked to find that the films were really full of magical content, which I'd never have guessed from what was written about them. I then went on to get the film with colleagues, get the films back into distribution, and I wrote program notes and booklets for the Arts Council of England, who were incredibly supportive, funded the work. They had a really wonderful film officer working there called David Curtis, who just understood completely the importance of getting Deren's work back into distribution. So we did that. And for about 10 years, I used to travel all over the UK screening her work at all sorts of venues, kind of large urban ones and small out-of-the-way rural ones, anywhere that wanted to see them. So that was my introduction to the work, really.
Your own films, are they symbolist? Are they magical? And do you are you still making films now?
Yeah, I'm not making films now. I made a number of films when I was in my 20s, which are all held at the British Film and Video Artists Archive at St. Martin's School of Art. And people are kind enough to write about them from time to time. They were very much magical films, yes.
And those would be under Judith Noble?
No, they'd be under the name Judith Higginbottom. I got married a few years ago and changed my name, so those would probably be best known under the name Judith Higginbottom.
Obviously, Kenneth Anger was influenced by Aleister Crowley. Was Maya Deren ever, did she ever have anything to do with Aleister Crowley?
Not directly, no. As I'd done a lot of research on where her interest in occultism came from, and she seems to have read Francis Barrett's book, The Magus, which would have been, you know, a fairly standard kind of go-to magical work at the beginning of the 1940s when, you know, not that much was available. And she had contact with various occultists in the late 1930s and the early 1940s, very notably Alvin Lustig, who was a graphic designer. I don't think that, as far as I can tell, that he had direct contact with Crowley, but there is an indirect link because she researched a book on witchcraft for the writer William Seabrook. That's a book called Witchcraft, Its Power in the World Today, which was published in the U.S. in 1941. And Seabrook had worked with Crowley in the U.S. in 1919. And Seabrook was extremely influenced by him. There aren't many records of, you know, conversations between Deren and Seabrook as she was doing this research, so I don't know whether Crowley was talked about, but there was that indirect link.
Can you tell us more about Seabrook? I heard you mention him in the talk as well.
Yeah, William Seabrook was a journalist and a writer of kind of very, very mass-market popular books on quite sort of, I suppose you call them salacious subjects, witchcraft from a rather shock horror point of view, cannibalism, voodoo, etc. There's a bit more to him than that. He'd had contact in the late 20s and early 30s with the Surrealists, and he had written articles for a journal edited by Georges Bataille called Document. He then had a falling out with the Surrealists and Bataille, and returned to New York. He wrote a book on voodoo in the late 30s. And Deren was trying to scrape a living as a freelance writer before she made films in 1940. And she just answered a job advert and went and did the research for his book. He was quite a bizarre character. He subsequently asked her to go and participate in experiments in what he described as extrasensory perception at his very isolated farmhouse home in upstate New York. And off she went, and she discovered when she got there that these were really kind of S&M games designed for Seabrook's sexual gratification, and she challenged him on this, and he admitted that was the case, and she went away very quickly back to New York without actually doing any of this stuff. There's a very full account of it in the wonderful biography of her, The Legend of Maya Deren, the second volume of that, where her letters about it to various people are reprinted. Yeah, you know, that was her contact with Seabrook. She was an extremely feisty person by all accounts, and I think she really got the better of him. He had been treated for alcoholism before this, and he committed suicide some years after. A kind of, you know, strange fringe character. I've got a copy of the book that Deren helped to research, Witchcraft, Its Power in the World Today, and it's a kind of cross-cultural study of witchcraft. It's very accessible. It makes a couple of good serious points, but it's essentially a kind of it's pulp nonfiction, I would have said.
It's rather interesting, though, that both Maya Deren and then Kenneth Anger both have connections or indirect connections to Aleister Crowley. Aleister Crowley seems to have gotten his tentacles into like every aspect of American pop culture, and I guess English too, pop culture for pretty much the entire 20th century. I mean, even after he was dead, he was still influencing rock and roll heavily, wasn't he?
Yeah, but very much so. Although I would have said that the links with Deren are actually very indirect. and she never references him, and I think that she's in her very kind of intellectual, classical outlook on life, probably a million miles from Crowley's approach to the world.
Yeah,
although you could say that what they both have in common was a formidable intellect, I would guess. But with anger, it's completely different. You know, anger is inspired by Crowley, is happy to say that, and references Crowley very explicitly in his films. I'm sure you're aware, you know, there are points in various of the films where Crowley's image appears on screen, and so there's no doubt about that at all. I would like to advance the theory, I think, that part of the influence of Crowley on pop culture is actually due to Kenneth Anger and his films.
Really?
I think without Anger's films that Crowley would not have had the influence that he has. Anger's made his, you know, popularized Crowley's work.
How is that, though? The Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, they were all, and what is it, Led Zeppelin or Jimmy Page or something? I don't even know all these bands.
Yeah,
that
Jimmy
but
Page,
they were all introduced to Crowley through Anger. And were they seeing his Anger's films somehow, or how did that work?
The Rolling Stones were very definitely introduced to Crowley's work by Kenneth Anger, because Kenneth Anger worked with the Rolling Stones in London between 1966 and 69. Some people have described him as their muse, and he was very heavily influential on their work. He was introduced to them by Anita Pallenberg, who was at the time the partner of Brian Jones, and then later the partner of Keith Richards. So there's an incredibly direct link there. But I think what Anger's works were being very widely exhibited in London in the mid 60s.
Were they?
And yeah, phenomenally. I saw all sorts of places at gigs. You can look back at programs for various music clubs were in the psychedelic scene in London that was just beginning to grow up in 65 and 66. And you'll see, you know, all-nighters with lists of five or six bands playing, and in between, you know, somewhere in the middle of the night, they're showing Anger's movies. So Anger's movies became very widely seen in the London, you know, countercultural psychedelic scene of the mid-60s.
That's kind of strange. It's kind of strange that they weren't really shown in L.A. at all, right?
I gather not. I think partly to do with the fact that at the time, you know, the greatest proselytizer for Anger's works was Anger in person, and Anger was in London.
Okay.
And so, you know, it makes sense that the films are really widely seen in London, and perhaps only later in Los Angeles and San Francisco. You know, Anger went back to live in the U.S. in 1969. And from then on, you know, was showing his films very widely. They were being seen, and he was working, particularly in San Francisco. Part of a large part of Invocation of My Demon Brother, which was released in 1969, is a filmed ritual which Anger performs at the Straight Theatre on the autumn equinox in 1966. So he was certainly around, you know, and working in San Francisco at the time. But maybe, you know, the London scene was just more conducive to looking at films that way.
Looking at films outside the cinema.
Yeah. Sorry.
What theater was that in San Francisco that he performed the ritual at?
It was a place called the Straight Theater, which is a wonderfully ironic name, isn't it, for anything that Kenneth Anger had to do with.
Yeah.
He thought at the time that he was making his film Lucifer Rising, but he abandoned the first version of that and used that footage in Invocation of My Demon Brother.
So those were offcuts then?
I don't think they were offcuts. He tells a lot of stories about what happened to the film. At the time, he was very closely involved with a man called Bobby Beausoleil, who had been kind of fringe figure on the music scene, and sadly is now best remembered because he subsequently became a member of the Manson family and is serving a life sentence
At San Quentin, yeah. I saw his Facebook page. He has a Facebook page with some of his music on it. Yeah, it's great.
It's often erroneously believed that he was one of the people who murdered Sharon Tate. He wasn't. He'd already been arrested when that murder happened. He'd taken part in the murder of someone called Gary Hinman.
Yeah.
But he had been involved with Anger, and Anger intended that he would play Lucifer in Lucifer Rising. And in 1966, there was some kind of immense falling out. I'm trying to be careful to get this right, because this is a very contested story. Anger said that Bobby Beausoleil stole the footage of Lucifer Rising, and therefore he had to abandon the film. But Bobby Beausoleil has always denied this, and as quite a large chunk of that original footage has actually turned up in Invocation of My Demon Brother. You know, make of that what you will. As the Crowleyites would say.
Do you think that does Kenneth Anger say anything about whether or not he had influence on the Mansons or not? Or do you know?
No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. And I don't think he would have done, because as far as I or anyone else can ascertain, Bobby Beausoleil didn't meet the Manson family until a couple of years after he'd parted with Anger.
I see. Okay, and you've interviewed Kenneth Anger, you said, more than once.
I talked to him some years ago now, when he was showing his work in London and exhibiting his photographs. Yeah.
Do you remember what you guys had a conversation about, or what you mentioned?
Well, they were very much at the time the conversations of a fan. You know, I am a fan of Anger's work, and I'm not sure I'd dignify the conversation to the name interview. Just me explaining how much I like the work and asking a couple of questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Back to Mick Jagger. Mick Jagger, in I think it's the video for Sympathy for the Devil, like the music video for it. He's dancing on the catwalk or whatever he's on, and he has tattoos of the devil on his chest or his arm. Was that a result of having been exposed to Anger and Crowley?
Very, very, very much so.
Really?
Anger inspired the Rolling Stones in interest in the figure of Lucifer, and the lyrics to Sympathy for the Devil are very much about a Miltonian conception of Lucifer as the rebel angel who brings freedom and knowledge to mankind, and that comes very directly from Anger. But I think what's also quite interesting is that there was a fascination with this idea of Lucifer in the London scene in the mid 60s, and several writers have referred to it. I think Tony Raines probably coined the phrase at the time as Luciferian London. And one of the other fascinating figures, also sadly no longer with us, in that scene was Donald Cammell. Donald Cammell is best known as the co-director of Performance, a feature film, and later the director of Demon Seed. And Cammell's work on Performance is, of course, quite extraordinary, but that film stars Mick Jagger. And Cammell was quite celebrated in London in the mid-60s because his father, who was a rich Scottish shipyard owner, had been briefly in the 1930s very good friends with Aleister Crowley. And when Donald Cammell was a little sort of two-year-old, three-year-old lad, Aleister Crowley had on several occasions been his babysitter.
I know.
That sounds
pretty amazing.
Delightful, absolutely delightful.
Wow.
So Cammell enjoyed a kind of considerable kind of cachet in London in the 1960s. Wow, you know, you were babysat by Aleister Crowley. What was that like? Probably he like most of us don't remember that much about when we're two or three. But there's Donald Cammell, and Donald Cammell was also very influenced by Kenneth Anger. You know, they were around the Rolling Stones at the same time. In that same milieu, which was all centered around Robert Fraser's art gallery. So there was a scene around that. Robert Fraser was bringing work by new American artists, mainly pop artists, and showing work by new British artists. The people who are hanging out at the gallery, attending the openings and the parties and buying the work with the Rolling Stones and the Beatles too, very much. You know, Paul McCartney was one of Robert Fraser's great customers, and Donald Cammell was there, and Kenneth Anger was there. Kenneth Anger actually lived in one of Robert Fraser's apartments, and that apartment features in Lucifer Rising. So they were all there together. So there's Anger. He's very much influencing Donald Cammell. You can really see that in performance. And Cammell is on record as saying Anger at the time was his greatest influence. And there's Mick Jagger, very much enjoying learning all this Luciferian stuff from Kenneth Anger and writing the fabulous, you know, three-note repetitive Moog soundtrack for Invocation of My Demon Brother, and then he stars in Cammell's film Performance. So there are all these very close links.
Was there any cross-pollination between Andy Warhol Factory and the Fraser Gallery, by any chance?
Not especially. Fraser was showing works by Lichtenstein, Jim Dine, all manner of pop artists, and I think he had a couple of Warhol pieces, but I don't think there was too much direct connection, although I haven't researched that in any great detail. There's a lovely book on Robert Fraser. It's called Groovy Bob. It's by a writer called Harriet Viner, and really recommend that if anyone wants to look at that whole nexus of connections that, you know, coming from Robert Fraser, who's a fascinating figure and kind of animating that scene in London in the 60s.
And then Mick Jagger cuts off relations with Kenneth Anger at some point?
Yes, he does.
Is Mick Jagger having some kind of like revelation that Christianity's good, or is he just like sick of messing with demons? Or
well,
whatever?
Maybe you could, you know, it'd be nice to ask him. I wouldn't presume to have any idea what was in Mick Jagger's mind, but the commonly accepted view is that what finally finished this whole flirtation with the occult, with Lucifer, with the idea of the devil for the Rolling Stones was the Altamont Festival in the U.S., which we can all look at in the Males Brothers film Gimme Shelter, where one of the audience was killed by Hell's Angels who were supposedly providing security at the gig. It's generally held, and I think you can check this in Keith Richards' rather wonderful autobiography, Life, which is a great read. He confirms that. So you know, they were really into this idea, and he was, and Anita Pallenberg, his partner, was very into this Luciferian idea, and that death and the whole process that went on there, I think, you know, made them turn away very, very much from...
Was that person, the person who died, was they trampled or something? Because it sounds almost like they were sacrificed or something, and that turned them off.
Well, that could be one way of reading it, but mm-hmm. I think it's just a horrible murder. You know, that this was a kind of festival gig that went wrong, and they give various accounts of it. They thought it was like another lovely American festival gig in the spirit of Woodstock, and when they got there, there was realized the atmosphere was really horrible.
Well, that's in the Bay Area, right? In San Francisco Bay Area.
I don't know. I
don't either. But if it's in the Bay Area, if it's in the Bay Area, then there's a lot more. It's a more harsh environment.
Yeah, I know it's an old speedway track of some kind.
Yeah, I think that is. I think that might be in the East Bay. I grew up in the East Bay. And you mentioned the Hell's Angels, and I grew up in Richmond, and the Hell's Angels, people think they originated in Oakland, but I think they actually originated in Richmond, just as a side note there.
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know, as a Welsh woman, my geography of the American West Coast not terribly wonderful.
Well, I won't look it up right now, but... okay,
but, you know, this young fan who was just there to enjoy the music was murdered by the Hell's Angels, who had taken it upon themselves to provide security. And, you know, that seems to be the absolute turning point, although there's also quite a lot of evidence beforehand that the Rolling Stones got a bit fed up with Kenneth Anger anyway, and that they were moving on, and that period was over. And I think he they were really his patrons. One of the astonishing things about Anger, which is a considerable achievement, is he's never really had any public funding or financial support to make his films from any kind of organized source. And the Invocation of My Demon Brother and Lucifer Rising have, by all accounts, had quite a lot of the Rolling Stones money in them, and I think it just got to the point where that was enough and too much.
Well, that's interesting because I often think of Kenneth Anger as being sort of the rebel in Hollywood, right? And he's like a counter to Hollywood commercialism. But now, after what you just said, it almost sounds like he may be a distillation of Hollywood.
Well, he's a really complex figure, and I think it's hard to reduce someone as kind of as important as Anger to a couple of simplistic ideas, really. But he is a complex figure because he, from a very early age, he was fascinated by Hollywood. He lived as a child in Hollywood. He used to, in his childhood and teens, he used to look at and indeed play in the mouldering huge sets of D.W. Griffith's films, which were still there. And he had family members who worked in the silent film industry. So from the off, he was a Hollywood kid, and he loved silent cinema. And Hollywood is such a complex beast, isn't it? That, it's possible to be a rebel, but also love some things about it as well. So,
well, yeah, that's my point, really, is that I do actually consider Kenneth Anger to be extremely important and his movies to be of utmost importance. And I think that they're much more important than any Hollywood movies. But that's what I'm just thinking. There does seem to be a dichotomy between him being an outsider and him being the spirit of Hollywood,
I think so. I think that's absolutely spot on.
Yeah.
I mean, his films are steeped in the visual language of silent cinema. He loves popular culture, references to all manner of films and popular music, The Wizard of Oz, etc., etc. But at the same time, he's working in a completely different way, and it would have been impossible to make a Kenneth Anger film in the kind of Hollywood industrial complex. They're made frame by frame, handmade, beautiful artifacts.
Yeah.
Hollywood could not begin to make a film like that. It just would be totally impossible.
Well, they're just so beautiful. That's the thing about them. And I've actually been thinking about the concept of what is it about this kind of dark, satanic, because that is the word that we need to use, satanic or Luciferian genre of art. What is it about it that makes it so rich? Is it specifically Kenneth Anger that made this rich, beautiful imagery, and he just happens to be a Luciferian or a Crowley devotee? Or is it that there's something innate and innately inherent about satanic iconography that is in itself rich and beautiful?
Well, I'd see it slightly differently myself, because I think what Anger does is that if you look at Aleister Crowley's work, it's written work, and the art form of most mid-20th century occultists was the book. And he writes in great depth about a web of symbolism, about constructing rituals, all of which have complex uses of color and objects and performance elements to them. But they're essentially writings. And what Anger does is he takes all that stuff and makes it visual.
Mm-hmm.
So in his films, he's using Crowley's color symbolism. He's adding to it, but his films are in themselves magical artifacts. They're works of art, and they're magical artifacts. And he's expressing all those principles, but in his own way. I consider them to be works of genius. And absolutely unique. So for me, it's not a question of, is this Is it the Luciferian current that throws up these works? Really, it's no, anger is part of the Luciferian current, but he's interpreting it in his own way and making something very, very beautiful out of it.
But he is inheriting a sense of color and ritual from his predecessors.
Yes, he is. But by the time he makes his last completed film, Lucifer Rising, he's added to that. And mm-hmm. he's taken the mythos in his own direction. He's personalized it. And he's added his own layers of color symbolism, which actually weren't there in Crowley. He's not just slavishly following Crowley at all. He's creating his own layers of symbolism and.
Well, was Crowley influenced at all by the Golden Dawn? Because their ritualistic their ritualistic elements were all very colorful, weren't they?
Yes. Yes, Crowley began with the Golden Dawn and was very involved in it, but parted company with it after quite a short time, and then went on to do his other work. But yeah, the genesis of his ideas are come from the Golden Dawn. Yes.
So then, what we can see is this strain coming from basically beginning with the Golden Dawn. I think we can say that to a great extent. Coming a vein of this culture, and it's, we could call it counterculture, we could call it pop culture, but it is a legitimate culture traveling down through the 20th century. How is it related to other aspects of pop culture or pop culture as a whole?
Yeah, one of the great things about Anger is his influence on subsequent cinema and in a way on music too, because you see what Anger does, probably unintentionally when he starts out, is he invents a music video 20
really?
Years before it happens. Yeah, I mean this is to do with access to technology and means of filmmaking, because Anger has never made a film with diegetic sync sound. You know, where sound is recorded on the film or on a separate soundtrack as people speak it. There's no dialogue in an Anger film. And the reason for that was that he didn't have the means available to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so from the off, he was marrying up music with images. The music had to come afterwards. But he developed this really unique way. Starts really in Scorpio Rising, of using early 60s pop songs. Which work with and against his images. The irony, which is there there's loads of it in a wonderful irony in Scorpio Rising, comes from the way that we hear 60s girl group songs and counterbalanced and offset against the images he's showing us. And so there's a sequence in that film where we see bikers getting dressed for ritual, intercut with images from a kind of Bible society, Sunday school film, The Crucifixion of Jesus, and we hear the soundtrack. We hear She's a Rebel, He's a Rebel.
Oh, and, right, yeah.
You know, and that's become fairly standard way of using images in music video. But that was the first time anyone's seen it. And that all comes from Anger. So, yeah, he's had a profound influence on music through that, you know.
Was Custom Car Commandos like part of Scorpio Rising, or does that predate it? What's the difference between those two?
No, it's afterwards. And I think he probably intended it to be quite a large film, but couldn't get the resources to do it or whatever. And I love Custom Car Commandos. It's because it's the perfect marriage of his interest in pop culture, of his interest in magic, because it's a film about the tarot image, the chariot, and all the colours in it come from the Golden Dawn and Crowley's Princess colour scale. But it's, you know, it's a film about a hot rodder with again, you know, that lovely girl group kind of soundtrack. Very, very fond of that film.
Okay, and then you'd mentioned somebody named Jack Smith. Creatures.
Yes.
What is that referred to? I have no idea. I've never heard of
okay,
that.
Okay, Jack Smith was a filmmaker from the later period of the U.S. avant-garde, very active in New York in the early 60s, had come out of avant-garde theater and made a film which was very notorious, famous or notorious, choose your word, at the time, called Flaming Creatures, which was banned all over the place because it was very orgiastic. And it's a kind of a very, very wonderful, very, very messy film, impossible to describe in words, I'm afraid, but should be watched.
What do you see in the future of curation of art cinema?
Well, I don't know how too much about how it's working in the US, but that's happened in Britain already. That's happening right now. There's a great show on in London at the moment in Camden, curated by the filmmaker Guy Sherwin, great avant-garde filmmaker who's been active since the 70s. And, you know, that's a gallery show. The Tate Gallery here, both Tate Modern and Tate Britain, regularly show the work of artist filmmakers as gallery work. And the work is being looked at as part of art practice here completely now. It wasn't like that when I was starting to do it at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, because there was a kind of resistance by the more traditional art forms, painting, sculpture, etc., of seeing film as equal to them. But with the passage of time, that has mercifully gone away. So here, experimental film, artist film, is very, very much part of the visual arts. It's looked at that way, and you have major film artists like Tacita Dean exhibiting wonderful work at Tate Modern. And so that battle seems to have been won here, really.
Well, that's good to hear. That's very good to hear. How is it exhibited? Is it just looped, the films?
I think it depends on the artist and the work. I mean, according to the artist's intentions is the answer to that, really. So there's a lot of installations, where the work is really exhibited according to the artist's instructions. That might be loops, it might be on walls, it might be in all sorts of situations, multi-screen, etc. And other works which are designed for single-screen exhibition are shown that way. So Anger had a London show at Spruce Megger's Gallery in 2010, and they were projecting Invocation of My Demon Brother onto a wall in the gallery space. And it was the work was accompanied by a lot of his photographs and stills. And so it's really, the work is really exhibited in the way that the artist intends it to be, which is great. It's how it should be.
Do you think there will ever come a time where cinema art will be exhibited, say, on an iPad, on a loop, affixed to the wall next to paintings?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so, yeah.
My last question is, have you heard of the Abbey of Thelema and its current condition? Because obviously Kenneth Anger went there and restored the murals, the frescoes that Aleister Crowley did. But it's currently just basically falling down. And have you heard of anybody making an attempt to rescue it?
No, I haven't. I don't know what the state of play is, but I do know that down the years, it's something that's been looked on really unfavorably by the people of Sicily and by the Italian authorities, and I don't think there's any great rush going on to conserve it. I think it's a real shame, because I think it's a culturally significant building, and it should be. It should be preserved, but I'm not. It's not my specialist area, but I'm not aware of any particular attempts at the moment to conserve it. But I would hope it would be. And last I heard, it was in a very ruinous condition.
Yeah, it seems like somebody needs to go down and at least rescue the remaining frescoes, because apart.
It'd be tragic if all we we have Angus' lovely photographs of it, but it would be tragic if that's all that is. Handed down to future generations, I think.
Thank you for listening to The Great Work Radio. The Great Work Radio and blog are features of Jesse Waugh's website and can be accessed at jessewaugh.com. That's J-E-S-S-E-W-A-U-G-H.com. We look forward to comments submitted to the blog and hope you enjoyed today's program. To download the Great Work Radio program files, just search for the name Jesse War in the iTunes Store.